It's January 12th, Sunday, Toronto to Manhattan, Adam and Bob. Here you go.
Hello.
Hey, Adam.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, man, are you, you got anything to talk about?
Yeah, I do. I have a question for you. But before
do you have any sentences to say?
Yeah, before I actually get my question, I have a preceding question. I was wondering if you could explain to me the relationship between media and religion.
There's no difference nowadays.
Okay. Sorry, I'm just trying to think of how to phrase my thoughts here.
You want me to go into it more?
Nope. That's actually perfect for my second question.
Okay.
I'm currently reading a book. It's called By Way of Deception. And what it's about is it's talking about the Mossad and generally how they go about doing things.
Yeah, when was this book?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I think it was put out in the early 90s.
Yeah, by Claire somebody.
The last name's Ostrovsky.
Yeah,
and right.
The Toronto Sun writer Claire somebody was co-writer of it.
Right. That sounds right.
Yeah, it's an expose of the Mossad. The Mossad.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, when I'm reading about it, or when I'm reading it, there's this one particular part where they're talking about how most intelligence agencies are quite large, like they talk in the numbers of the thousands. But the Mossad themselves, they have about 30 case operatives, and they say that they can work that way because they have this huge group of volunteers, the Jewish community that assists them around the world.
Hmm.
So what my question is how do the Jewish community, or I guess religious communities in general, maintain such a fixed and cohesive identity together when they are scattered across the world, when faced with so many other, media influences barraging them on a regular basis? Like, how do they maintain that tight cohesion? Does that make sense?
Yeah, actually, what comes to mind immediately is the Jews are known as the people of the book.
Right.
So, their whole literate background holds them together. Now, if you read polls and surveys in the 90s, the Jewish community in North America and the bigger cities was getting really secularized, and there was actually not many people who were really being traditional Jews in ritual and form.
Right.
So what's interesting is the new media is diluting the old medium of book.
Right.
So, now, those that stick with the meme theme of the book and its meaning, that original manuscript, they become more fanatic and extreme in maintaining it because they're up against the new media, which creates new kinds of people.
Right.
So you're wondering how the Jews keep unified.
Well, I was talking about groups in general. I was just using that as an example because that's what inspired me to, on this train of thought.
Well, okay, that's where I say media and religion are the same thing.
Yeah. That's why I was wondering if there's an overwhelming force of media in so many different aspects affecting their lives. I mean, even a devout religious person only spends a certain portion of their day, right, in religious studies, so to speak. So how can that still maintain such cohesion if they spent 4 hours a day devoted to religion when they're overwhelmed almost 24 hours a day with media from so many different other sources?
It's more than overwhelmed. They've been disappeared. I say that the media and their parallel memes and collective effects are the only actors in the global theater.
Right.
And it's even come to the point where these actors are just after images, so there's nothing of anything anymore. So that leaves human beings in the middle of the media vortex, and as the media shrinks, the people are able to create their own realities, their own mixture of what they think is sacred. So what you have today, if you think of the war between Islam and the West, or Islam and the Israel, they are battles of collective memes that were created by different media for the media, and humans are just stunned at how irrelevant they are in the dealing with it. So we got a battle of media memes. And
now, what do you mean by memes? I don't understand.
A meme is a collective habit, a cultural habit.
Okay.
So just as we have genes that are passed on to
right.
our bodies.
Oh, me. Oh, like M-E-M-E?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I thought you were saying memes as an M-E-A-N-S. Got
yeah,
it. Okay, no.
Mean
yeah,
meme.
I know what a meme is.
So
yeah.
I call media memes now because after the satellite and the digital world took over in the 60s and 70s, media as separate media evaporated. So, like, we're not on just a telephone now. We're on a whole internet mesh network, especially if we're on a cell phone. I wouldn't even have to be tied to a phone apparatus. So a telephone is not a telephone as people had 40, 50 years ago.
Right.
So the cell phone can be many media, TV, radio, all kinds of things can be plugged into your little handheld.
Right.
So particular media as identified separately don't exist anymore. So they've converged, and we're all in that same media node. Now what is left is after images of previous media which had historical periods where they dominated. You have the movie period, you have the radio period, you had the newspaper period, then you had the telegraph period in between the newspaper and the movie, all right?
Right.
These were spans of 20, 30 years, and all kinds of things happened around the world in cultural institutions in response to these media. So those stages, if they and the media that instigated them merge and disappear, you still have the after image of the effects of the data created by each one of those media.
Right.
So you have, museums of television broadcasting, museums of Hollywood, and the Oscar and the Academy. So I say that these things represent the cohesiveness that former media created and stirred up. The after image, the collective habit, the collective media image, I call a meme.
Right.
It's more mental. It's more abstract, even though it's a physical reality.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying? So the memes are what are fighting. But right now, as the media, the converged media, synthesized media, gets tinier, we're left with human beings who are like cavemen, who have whole bodies and have been reestablished with that autonomy and only have to deal with tiny media. But the content of the media is these historical memes.
Right.
All right. So
that are left over?
Yeah, they're after images.
Oh, okay. Well, here's another question then. Like, let's say something you were saying.
What you said, this image you have of people who are dedicated to the book or go to a church or synagogue for an hour or a few hours and are overwhelmed by media, that's a fact of life. Just refining your perception. You know that's what people deal with. They don't live in that little geographical zone. They live in where the media takes them.
What about
right?
people? Yeah, okay.
And so there's what we're up against. And I just sort of made it a little more extreme.
Right.
Okay.
I was just wondering, what about people's perception of these memes? Like, let's say that however the book was originally written, if somebody wrote that when the written word was, I guess, the dominant meme, right?
Think of it as manuscript, because, the book is a printed medium. That's different.
Okay, from the manuscript. Then even people now, when looking at that, wouldn't they perceive it differently than as it was originally intended? I mean, even if it is just an after image that's left over, they wouldn't perceive it in the same way because they still would be affected by all those other various mediums.
That's right. We cannot experience the book society, the manuscript society, or even the 19th century industrial society. We cannot experience it the way people did. That's why it's even more of a meme. It's a collective memory. It's a Jungian archetype. Jung's archetypes only dealt with humans and some traditional human scale things like the wise woman, the wise man, the this, the that, more human body things. But we have these new bodies created by media, and a lot of them are after images, and so that's why we use the word meme. You can just see that we don't even experience what those media dynamics created in people when they surfaced as an environment, over the last 200 years. So that's even more mimetic. It's a collective nostalgia. So the older media are rituals. Reading the newspaper is a ritual. Watching a movie is a ritual. Where you live today is the effects of those media on other media, and you may be allowed to input occasionally.
Is not the purpose of a ritual, though, to reach some sort of epiphany at the end by following a set pattern so that you can kind of use it as a foci for understanding something greater? If these are if I'm interpreting you correctly, if these are outdated, then wouldn't performing the ritual be redundant?
No, I don't mean outdated. I'm saying that they don't affect us. Like, before I go back to answer what you said in the question, let's keep this in mind. Why was Enron? You've heard of Enron and the fiasco, right?
Yeah.
Everybody in the world's heard it because we all live in the same node. So what happened in Enron? The larger banks, Citicorp and that, what they did is that they would loan money to companies like Enron, and Enron was allowed to say that was a profit, not a debt.
Right.
All right, let's keep that ridiculous. interesting economic fact in mind to see how the modern media affects us and how it's different from the way media affected us before. So, yes, you asked for an epiphany. An epiphany is, it depends on what you mean by it. It doesn't mean necessarily arriving at a point of view that then is useful and all-encompassing, like an eternal truth. An epiphany could be a momentary pattern that solves a tension, and then you move on and new pressures come in, and then you wait till that gets epiphanized. And we have so many insights and patterns we have to recognize every day in the media environment that epiphanies become average things that people have all the time. So, and that's just a matter of psychic survival. Now, you mean, I guess, an epiphany that gives you the big picture or makes you feel comfortable in the big picture, right?
Or even something that, actually, I like what you said, something that's useful. And that's what it comes down to, right? If I don't know how to put this in words. If we're perceiving all these various, or if all the stimuli is barraging us, so we have to sort out what's useless and what's useful.
Yeah.
I guess anything that allows you, and I guess useful is subject to
right.
debate as well. But
it's
I mean, what is useful?
Anymore.
Yeah. What is useful?
Right. Well, let's go back to the Enron. What was useful is that the economy and money and what money meant, the cohesiveness it brings to a society, had to keep circulating, even though it could not be measured. Money could not be measured in the old ways. So that's why they had to keep money going, even though Enron had no money. The Fed had to keep its medium of money going. So through the banks, Citicorp and that, it lent money as an afterimage, as a meme to these companies who could say that they made a profit using that money. They didn't have to pay it back because the usefulness of keeping the meme going in actuality is underlined by uselessness. We can't use it in any previous way. It's just a meme to organize economic exchange, which then merges with all other activities. So just talking on the phone creates business today.
Right.
Creates wealth. So
that's good, is it not?
Depends on what the effects are.
But I mean, generating wealth ultimately, if benefits everyone, does it not? I mean, because money in itself isn't finite, right? So I mean, by generating wealth and continually redistributing it, does it not everyone benefit ultimately, or could they not? I should say.
Yeah, you'd have to define what you meant by distributing wealth because watching TV every day generates wealth. Watching the talk shows, watching the news,
right. Is
that useful? When, if you ever ask anybody, what do they make of the news, they just say, well, it's a lot of sensationalism.
Right.
It seems that the human being takes contradictory, schizophrenic stances in relation to the necessary processing of information, which is largely the wealth of today, processing entertainment, anything. Even driving your car is processing information nowadays, because you have to gauge how you're interacting with other cars and traffic lights and all this.
But couldn't everything be said, like, everything is processing information then?
Right. That's where we live today. And so if you actually try to define what it is, it won't work. So to define what we do today as distributing wealth, keeping wealth going, is not what's going on, because we know a lot of people feel so many pressures that they have to keep the pharmaceutical industries going with the drug consumption to handle it. And then that leads to body infections or body problems. But then that keeps the hospitals employed. So is simple performance, simple looking busy, really what wealth is? But that definitely is what wealth is today, because they have to keep this thing going, because so much of the complexity of the technological world we live in has to be maintained. We're shepherds for that. You follow
right.
What I'm the dilemma? I'm laying out a dilemma here.
Yeah.
Of definitions in that, because there are so many other cultures at different stages of media consumption that all of a sudden they have to assert themselves, so they knock out the World Trade Center. Was that good for creating wealth? It certainly created a lot of new wealth, just in terms of gave people the opportunity to talk about something new and have a new content for their media.
Right.
So the human being is expendable in relation to some parts of the wealth distribution and creation situation. So I certainly wouldn't say any sentence and say that's the way it's summed up. So
right.
When you say, well, isn't it good for all of us? There's a statement. that can be deconstructed and fractalized so many different ways. You know what I mean? So how are you going to maintain a vocal narrative in your head when you know it evaporates? Whatever you say in your head, and our heads are sort of logocentric, they just sort of say or see imagery that come in very puny amounts compared to what the environment is spreading around. So how long can you live with like a pinhead, with any of your statements not making, not being relevant to how to talk about the big picture? You either realize you can't talk about the big picture, or what?
But if you can't talk about the big picture, then what's the point?
Maybe we're learning to live with not needing a point.
But that just kind of seems...
Isn't that
I guess, the purpose of religion, to provide a point?
Right.
And if media is synonymous with religion, then shouldn't media be providing us a point?
It does provide...
No, but I mean one that's actually the big picture, one that's useful, like a useful meme as opposed to just...
Okay, then you get interesting, because the big picture... is an image that evokes the eye or some kind of visual framework, right? We don't live in a visual society. When you consider the amount of information that's swimming around you, you can't see it all. A lot of it's attacking you. So maybe the big picture has to be a tactile picture.
What does it have to be restricted?
And you know how you do a tactile picture? You start jogging. You get kinetic.
Right.
And you start exercising, doing aerobics, so you can see pop culture over the last 30 years has become more kinetic, as that's the way people manifest the big picture. But that is alienating for those book people and book memes and manuscript memes that go back that imagine the big picture as something you can see in your mind's eye. So you got a different kind of sensory bias there. Then you got a conflict. So what did you just say a minute ago?
I guess I was picturing, when we were talking about epiphanies or useful information.
Yeah.
How do I put this? I understand we're restricted, obviously, to sensory bias, because we only have our senses with which to view the world or our perception of it, right?
Within the different senses, there's a bias.
Okay, but shouldn't an epiphany in and of itself transcend that? Like, when you get it, when you just actually get it, it's something where... Doesn't it transcend that sensory bias?
Yeah, if you get me, you'll have an epiphany.
Pardon me?
If you get what I'm talking about, you'll have an epiphany.
Yeah.
But the and it's not the normal kind of epiphany that you hold on to. It might be an epiphany of how to deal with a process of perception that recycles, and then you know it's just going to come back again. But your question is, if we had an epiphany, would that be sustaining? Is that your question?
No, I think it's more... Okay, perhaps I'm getting confused, but...
No, that's all right. You know, I mean, I think you're... When you say you're getting confused, you're just becoming sensitive to the complexities of what we're saying, which is okay. I think that's an epiphany.
Okay. But is it a useful one?
yes, if you get good at handling it.
Right.
So... Okay, go back. Now, what were we going to say? Like, it's interesting to figure out what the word epiphany refers to.
Yeah.
Have you had an epiphany?
Ever?
Yeah.
I would like to think so, yeah.
All right. Is it still useful?
Well, no. I mean, by their very nature. I mean, they are, and it's understood, but once your reality, I guess, shifts, you become accustomed to it after time, and it just becomes part of the way it is, right?
Right, okay.
I mean, it no longer holds its, you're not conscious of it.
Right. Okay. So then you start looking for the next epiphany.
Right. Because you're climbing the ladder, right?
Not necessarily, but you are engaged in a natural process of the mind to look for new patterns or consolidating patterns after a period of data has been consumed. Right. Data, experience, whatever.
Right.
So if you know that your mind will always put it in order and give it an epiphany, that's an important epiphany in itself. So you can relax about trying to figure out what it is you're trying to figure out. No, I don't say it that way. You can relax about whatever pattern, the timing of the pattern showing up.
Right.
And probably that'll create even faster epiphanies once you get used to that. So the thing is, we'd seek a rest point. And it may be an image, it may be a feeling, or maybe a relationship. That's what humans seem to need. That's the cyclical nature of humans. Now, is our economy cyclical anymore? When you get an orbiting economy that's 24 hours a day of data transmitting at quantum speed, where's the cyclicity there? I don't think there's any. I think it's simultaneous and instantaneous. So you can't even have a length of time to make a cycle. But the human being requires cycles. So there's a disservice of the wealth excess we have. Humans can't find a way to have a cycle. Usually they take a cycle out of the environment they're in. So they make sure they watch certain shows or certain, just certain shows, whatever media, so, and participate in like baseball or sports, and that becomes their cyclicity. And if cyclicity is linked to religion and epiphany, now you see what I mean by media is today's religion.
Okay, just so I'm understanding, cyclicity is not synonymous with pattern, is it?
Yeah.
Because sports is pattern, but cyclicity actually has something more than that, doesn't it? I mean, in its simple form, like the seasons, right? I guess there is a pattern that they go through them continually, but each of them has its own
phase.
Which, and it's part of a further growing development cycle, right? I mean, even with cyclicity, you're still going somewhere. It's like a wheel cycles, but you're still moving forward, right? Whereas a pattern, you're just in a rut.
Okay, now you're putting certain meanings that are relevant to you in the word pattern, but
got it. Okay.
I'll accept that. There are cycles within cycles, so a pattern would be a temporary cycle that was moving within a larger cycle that wasn't apparent until you perceived that larger cycle. Maybe that's what you mean. I don't know why you would say would diminish the word pattern.
Okay.
You're not sure why.
No. I think I was just trying to.
But that's okay. You see how the mind works. It's dialectical. It has one says minor term, major term, you know, and it plays off major minor terms, and we each subjectively have different terms to do a dialectic with, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So you had pattern versus cycle. Pattern being minor term, cycle is larger term.
Well, no, I actually do perceive a pattern as obviously with the possibility of it being infinite because it can go on forever. I find that difficult to quantify. Like you can quantify something that's cyclical, at least in my head, immediately I can visualize something that's cyclical. Therefore, I can see this progression of movement. Whereas with a pattern, quite the opposite, it's larger, it's infinite. And because of its infinite, it's difficult to take those original steps. Does that make sense? Because because it's everywhere, there's no sense of movement.
Right, you put a mathematical, a visual reference onto the word cycle, rather than pattern.
Yeah, I'm pretty visually oriented.
I can't remember. Is it backwards?
Okay.
It was interesting. You call pattern could be infinite, right?
Well, pattern is infinite. It goes on forever, theoretically, right?
See, now we're getting what you mean by pattern is infinite, which I didn't think of.
Right.
But, you know, mathematics deals with infinities. How is a cycle used calling it mathematical? Different from the infinity of patterns.
Because a cycle is quantifiable.
Oh, okay.
Right. Even though it can repeat endlessly, you can watch its progression. So
right.
I guess to put it in my, I mean, I can only perceive the world through a certain, I guess, a limited perception. Something that's cyclical, I can actually measure a growth or change. Whereas with a pattern, just by its infinite nature, I can't move anywhere on it.
Okay, that's interesting. We might keep in mind that supposedly we have two halves of our brain, and one deals with more mathematical things and the way you're defining a cycle, and another looks at patterns or right hemisphered mosaics or something. It's interesting you think that pattern goes infinite, because infinite is a visual image. Maybe you also mean eternal, like sound going on forever. You would hear something.
I picture pattern as I'm a visually oriented person.
Right.
So when I picture a pattern, I see it as an image, like a grid that spans everywhere.
Right.
Or no, but not necessarily even visual, because I do have a fundamental belief in I guess a pattern to reality or to creation. Like everything is interconnected, and you can just draw from the patterns of seeing everything from even just like a little leaf or whatever. The pattern of it, I don't know how to describe it. I'm sorry, I'm having difficulty putting this into words, but is represented everywhere else, right?
Look at why you can't describe it. It's a different image than a quantity. A quantity is pages, something you put on a piece of paper, or mathematical, you can see it more.
Right.
So you're calling yourself a visual person, but there's some other modalities in your brain that you're trying to, you can't visualize, which you're referring to as pattern. which I would say is moving out of the eye into either touch or movement sphere, but maybe more touch in its sense of going in all these different directions.
Well,
that's the last gasp of the visual image of what is not just visual, right?
See, when I'm picturing the infinite pattern of the universe, so to speak, right? I don't perceive myself as sensing it with any of my five senses. It's just something that's there that's kind of right.
That's your mind.
Okay. Does a mind have its own sense?
Yes. McLuhan called it tactility. It was the thing. It was the process or function that integrated the five senses to make coherent consciousness. And it wasn't a sense. So we might say, well, if it's not a sense, it's the mind or the brain.
But it transcends all of them. Is it kind of like the sum of the parts is greater than each of them individually?
Yeah.
That kind of idea.
It's the thing that does that.
Okay, and that would be an epiphany, right? I guess for me, that's what I picture an epiphany being, is when you transcend the limitation of any of your one senses to be able to grasp that bigger picture.
I think it means for you touching back on thought. When thought.
What does that mean?
I'm not sure. It was just a nice phrase. Thought touching itself. Think of thought as tactile. But it's like the thinking that's involved in sorting out data at some point can stand back from it and think a larger pattern.
Oh, is that kind of like as it is above, so it is below, but inversely, or microcosm, macrocosm? That kind of idea?
No, I think that's too visual. Because think of the word anamorphosis, which is a medieval form of painting. You've ever heard of it?
No. What is it? I'm sorry, can you repeat the word?
Say anamorphic. But
oh, yes, okay. Okay. I think I'm familiar vaguely with anamorphic.
Yeah, you think of a black hole in astrophysics, and all this matter is going into this thing that has so much gravity pulling in on itself that you can't visualize where it goes. It just collapses on itself, all right?
Okay.
So think of anamorphic refers to, in a way, medieval surrealism, where they would show a collage of different images going in different places, different directions, and it's revolving around a black hole, which is the total meaning of the picture, which you can't see or perceive. So every little fragmented surrealistic part reflects the whole. That's different from a hologram, because a hologram, what was it? What do you call it? As above, so below. That's like a fractal. As above is something you can know, and it's mirrored in the below. The anamorphic is beyond mirroring, which is where we actually live today, in an anamorphic situation. And if tactility, the thing that does the thinking, can't be seen, our technology have mimed that and created an environment that's like our thinking mechanism. We can't see it or hear it, but it processes us. So if you want to say it's as above, so below, that dualism in consciousness, that's one way to say it. But I'm just clarifying how we use our words in reference to it.
Right. Okay, I'm going to have to at some point go back and re-listen to this, because I think I picked up what you said, but I don't have it as an entirety.
Right, no, I'm saying a lot, especially it's a matter of me, at a certain level, just throwing some words, new words at you and pretending they're coherent, emphasizing their coherence, and you haven't had a chance to process that.
Yeah.
So that's okay if you go back. The point is, what do you think now with what you got? And we go on within the moment here.
Right.
We don't. Now, what's interesting, just think that the fact that we could tape it and go back.
Right.
There's how technology has allowed you to be a different person than someone 100 years ago. They couldn't do that. They might have a good memory, or they might have someone write it down and then they reread it. But rereading it is different from rehearing it. So note that your mental processes are assuming and requiring a part of yourself, the tape recorder, to clarify a present experience. So it's part of you.
Right.
And it's, you know, people say, well, it's not in my body. No,
oh, no.
It's your body uses it.
Oh, certainly. No, no, that makes sense. I mean, I would imagine it being just, technology is just another step in human evolution, really, right?
Right.
I mean, it extends me, but that doesn't really matter.
Why does modern medicine, when they examine a patient, they only look at the physical body? They don't look at the TV, the media, the chemistry, the other things, that the prosthesis that they use. When they examine the body, there's
right.
the rearview mirror, the obsolescence of medicine right there.
Well, yeah, but isn't medicine not by its very nature? Well, no, I shouldn't say that. I'm just okay. If you were to go back in time, so to speak, to the Dark Ages, right? There were doctors, and they were struggling to learn how to repair the human body in various ways, right? So that didn't make science. That wasn't obsolete by any means. It was just that they were still learning the tools because it's a science that evolves. So at this point, I mean, it's still perhaps like they're in the Dark Ages, and while they're still using the tools that they've learned in the past, it's still growing and changing. It doesn't make it obsolete. It just means that it still needs to progress forward, does it not?
Are you willing to put your hands in someone who's still practicing?
But that's the very nature of medicine, is it not? I mean, it always has been.
Ah.
I mean, they make mistakes, but, I mean, they can occasionally fix things as well. And,
there may be other medicines that you're not aware of that could help you. How do you know which medicine tradition has slowed down in relation to others? You know, some may be better.
I see what you mean, right.
So just think of the images you mean by medicine. You mean hospitals and whatever you in your experience in Canada think is what you categorize. But there's whole cultures of all other kinds of medicine.
Mm.
And you could find out about these right now, even though you couldn't 50 or 100 years ago, because it was not as small as world as it is now. So you see how the conditioning you are, that you're a Canadian or whatever you are, the particular environment, limits you to the actual potential of what you can learn today. So the kids shouldn't be going to school. They should be allowed to travel around different cultures.
Well, I certainly agree with that.
Right.
I'm not a big fan of schools, but yeah.
Because they even say, you know, you've got to learn how to read and write, the basics. Just don't take too long to read. But if you read and emphasize it too much, then the kids become solidified with those biases.
And they become trapped.
Yeah. Well, not even that. They become solidified. You know, they have habits of thinking that never can be loosened up. And then when they go into working life, they don't even need those habits. That's probably why education doesn't even educate anymore. It's been forced to change and adapt to a post-literate situation. They just let the kids hang around.
Right.
The discipline in schools is so different from 30, 40, 80 years ago. So another thing to do is if we are all in one node, then the cultures are right here in your room. You just have to tap into it by whatever media resource, the Internet.
Right.
So the thing is, to define yourself as local is really missing the point.
Well, doesn't there need to be some definition? I mean, doesn't it really kind of marginalize all of these different things if you don't see them as being distinct and individual? And
well, certainly for humans there needs to be a definition. That's
right.
The way the mind works. It takes data and filters it. That's the normal process of consciousness. And humans will do that regardless. So that's why they stay in their local cultures. Local media biases, because one naturally has to benefit. But we are not in a human situation. We're in a cyborgian, inhuman, post-human media world that is not operating with that limited scope of the human. And the humans constantly has to wrestle with that. And you could even say the human stubbornness, talk about wealth creation, the human resistance to the cyborg, the stupidity is good for us because it stops the imminent destruction of the human. So we should be actually celebrating stupidity.
Well, wait. Do you say the destruction of the human? You're talking about the evolution into something different or to the actual mass destruction? Changing from, if humanity changes from what it's currently perceived as into something else, that isn't the destruction per se. It's just a change, right? Am I perceiving what you're saying?
That's a valid statement. I would say, though, that the destruction is very hard to measure because at a certain point an adult cannot keep up, and then they fall off to the wayside. But the young kids can keep up.
Right.
So how much is that a problem? Maybe that's human nature. It cycles. You accept that. But it's very hard to determine the degree of destruction and who is being destroyed and at what point. You know that you hear nothing. If you look at them, if you listen to the average news content, it's quite an inventory of violent scenarios offered to people.
Right.
And all kinds of statistics. You know, like just take obesity in North America. right? There's never been so many kids so fat as ever before. Is that an evolution? Are they adjusting to something new that we're projecting an old image on that's not relevant? You know, you can't get one. As science learns more, technology learns more, they learn actually nothing but more and more uncertainty.
Right.
Which then creates lots of room, lots of wealth creation for endless talk shows to have people argue as experts. Right? If we didn't have all the certainty, we wouldn't have all these talk shows. Damn sure glad we got this uncertainty, or you wouldn't have any content on the media.
Right.
So obviously we're supposed to be more and more ignorant and more less knowing, in the sense of an epiphany, of a stopping point. Oh, now we know this.
Right.
Because if we did do that, then we wouldn't have the content. So obviously we're in a game of play now. We're just playing with our memes, our media imagery. That's not what's defined. People call it work. They call it school. They call it a university. They call it recreation. No, play is not recreation.
You say play is not recreation?
Right.
Can you further define that?
No, I think that I'm saying that on purpose so that you think about it. In other words, I'm asking you to figure out what I could have meant by that. If I give you the answer, then it either meets your expectations or it doesn't, and you can discard it. But I would say, let's leave that as something to think about tomorrow. How is play not recreation? Well, one thing is that most of society today in its work operations in North America is interactive communication, which is quite playful compared to the slavery and hardware work that people had to do 100 years ago, 500 years ago. Look at us. Look what we're doing now. We're just talking. And yet we are working in a way. We're playing.
I'm just trying to...
Okay, what is work to you then? Obviously, play is recreation. So, what is not recreation? Let's define what you mean.
No, that's not. You're right. No, you're right. Well, see, work can also be play and recreation, though. I don't see necessarily. I mean, those are pretty. We're just allocating things into little name slots or symbols.
Right.
I'm sorry. If you can just hold on 1 second.
Yeah.
Sorry, dog's barking.
Wait, is that outside? You guys outside?
No, I was just out in the hall.
Oh, you went out in the hall?
Yeah.
Where's Matt?
He's right beside me now.
What?
He's right beside me now.
Oh, why did you go in the hall?
It was just comfortable.
Oh, okay.
He's listening on the headphones.
Right. Okay, so the...
okay,
sorry
about
that. Matt and I were talking about this the other day, is people have more time, then they assert their identity, and think a lot of various things become competitive. And which was maybe assigned to specifically recreation 30
right.
years ago. So the competition and the play. So the recreational specialized activity now has slipped into daily life. So in that sense, play is bigger than what we call recreation.
Okay.
It's a more comprehensive term because the boundaries between idleness and work have disappeared because so much of work, actual work, how people get what they do to make some money, is not hard labor.
Right. Okay. I see. Okay. It's a little clear to me now. I was having difficulty understanding because my definition of certain terms
right.
was drastically different because I don't see there being work and idleness per se because,
right.
I mean, to accomplish anything requires, I see work as being exerting effort towards something. And even things I enjoy, like my recreational activities, require a certain amount of work in order to be able to accomplish anything of any value.
Right, but play is, you know, requires a lot of focusing and a lot of work if you're playing
yep.
seriously.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's yeah. why I was having difficulty with the definitions of work and recreation and play.
Yeah, part of perception would be to realize a term that one uses
right.
out of habit mm-hmm. actually could be used by another term, and then that loosens up the pattern recognition ability. You realize, oh, well, I don't need to focus on that term because if you actually look into it
right.
in semantics, it doesn't fit what I'm actually doing.
Right.
And that would be natural. If we get new technologies, and they have been shown in history to create new languages, they change language. And we've got so many languages now, I mean, so many new technologies, therefore they would change our spoken words, our language, even more rapidly, and probably, if you're against stupidity, we don't keep up enough with it. but if you're pro stupidity and like you see the value of the retarding of this endless mutation, then it'd be good that you stick with a certain meaning of work and insist on that, and not allow the term play to be mingled with it.
Right.
But you know, kids wear the fad of wearing your baseball hat backwards and rather looking sloppy. Even though there's been fads of you always sort of looking sloppy, but the extra sloppy thing of hanging pants down and dragging them along and kind of interrupting your stride.
Right.
Why did they take to that fad 10 years ago, let's say, well, 10 years ago, whenever it came in? It was almost the kids saying, hey, slow down. Let's be stupid. Let's make things inefficient. And that may be why the clothes became baggy. And then you turned your baseball cap around so that you're using the catcher position of your hat in baseball. You know, the catcher has his hat back because you have to catch so much information coming at you. So the actual style of clothing by kids 10, 12 years ago fit the needs of the present, of that time, you know, of the last 10 years.
But do you really think there was that much thought put into it? You think that's a natural evolution? Like I can hear what you're saying and see that. I mean, turning the hat backwards could represent this. But yeah, I mean that's.
But you know what thought is? Thought is our simple univocal language in our mind, which is so puny compared to the many languages and media around us, and we don't know what the body and the group mind or meme, how it responds to this stuff.
Right.
Yeah, to these new media. So no individual thought was put into it, but the group all agreed to do it. And it's very hard probably to measure this meme generation. But you can notice when it shows up and when it disappears, and then you might look at the larger technological environment to see if that molded that meme, evoked it.
So then humanity as a whole is basically slaves to this memes? Because the memes actually dictate our lives. Well, I know we create them, but, I mean, we have no control over them once they're created, and we really even have no awareness of them.
But we wouldn't want to have control over them. I think there's a part of people that likes to conform, to be with other people and share similarities. So we want to be controlled. It's only, you'd have to name a particular context of that points out the disservices of being controlled.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, What don't you want to be controlled in?
Oh, I wasn't saying whether I wanted to or not. I wasn't saying it either beneficially or in a derogatory manner. I was just clarification.
No, you were raising the meme, the assumption that we hear it all the time. It's not good to be controlled.
No, I never said that.
Oh, okay, that's
I would have never placed an assumption on that. I mean, I think it's pretty much, I mean, if we're to function as a society, there has to be a certain level of control.
All right, so, but you did say something about, you said, well, what if we didn't think that? You talked about how, well, did they think of doing that? And I said, no. And then it was a collective conformity.
Oh, right.
There was that negative implication of control, right? Right? That thought, right? That point there.
Oh, no. I was sorry, I'm just trying to think back on the conversation.
Well, I misinterpreted that when you raised the question, well, aren't we being controlled? I thought you...
Oh, no. I was stating it more as a fact. I don't necessarily think either positively or negatively towards it. In regards to, I was just trying to picture it in my head of these memes, which are basically entities that we've created,
right.
Are actually controlling. Well, not even controlling, but, I mean, they're the... I don't know. I'll have to think about that.
Yeah, in other words, the word control maybe is not what you meant. The implications, the normal assumptions of what control means, you meant something else. I'd say it's a sharing.
Right.
Communication is sharing. And humans are naturally shareware. They share in all their different forms of communication. And there has to be a bit of similarity for communication to happen. But you notice humans don't want too much similarity. They want a little difference to change it up, to make it not so repetitive. So we're constantly improvising and constantly preserving.
Well, I would imagine there's also, too, the struggle for identity, right? Because although we want to be part of a greater whole and want to have the safety of community and such, there is also the desire for personal recognition.
So it would seem to me that doubleness is one of the main characteristics of humans. We have these double trends, double tendencies.
Right.
You know, and some people say, well, that's schizoid or this and that, and they put a pejorative meaning on it, but we should celebrate our doubleness because it works for us.
But it could even be more than doubleness, too. Because I'm picturing you have individual, then you have, say, a national identity, then theoretically a global identity, or it has...
Then you have your media identity.
Yeah, I mean,
so
numerous levels.
Now that's where you come to my term quadrophrenia. I have a term for that. You've worked your way into my trap here. Yeah, the doubleness that's in simple human consciousness has been squared, simulated by technology. So we have two doublenesses, which we call quadrophrenia. Now notice the sequence you want. You have your local identity, then your national. Then you, what do you have to do after your national? You'd have to have your media identity, which some people might call global, but actually...
Or international.
The point is, it's out of your local reality, and it's in a big space. And that space now is just in our telephone. It's not big in visual terms. It's a resonating node that we all participate in. We can call that global, international, intergalactic. But the point is, that's a part of our identity now.
Right. And so, I mean, in essence, when people, let's say, you have famous media personalities, say like an actor or such, and when people view them or idolize them or such, what they're actually viewing is the media identity, and not it has really nothing to do with the person
that's
in and of itself.
Right. I was just reading about how in New York here, how I didn't know this, I'm not tracking it, but a newspaper pointed out to me that the relationship between Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez, that is such a big obsession for 20-year-old people in their 20s, women maybe, and they're reacting to this media image, which probably is a reflection of where they think they are in their lives. And
right.
You imagine if it was all about like you and me,
yeah,
Adam and Bob, everybody.
Yeah.
If you were them,
yeah,
you'd be laughing your head off. You'd say shit. But the point is that people are so puny compared to the mega information nodes they're processed through.
Right.
It involves millions of people.
So
that's inhuman in terms of local human scale.
Doesn't it almost go back right to, you know, the Greek myths? And you have these mythic heroes, which are almost archetypes, which allow all of us to, when hearing those stories, to identify with key elements of them. And is this not a modern interpretation of that?
I would say, I'd look at the physical characteristics. You got what, 10,000 Greeks?
Oh no! Yeah, no. But
look at how puny it is.
Yeah, but I still mean like these. Let's say the Jennifer Lopez, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, they're larger than life. These media personalities really have very little to do with the actual people themselves.
Right, they're Greek gods.
Yeah. That's what they're our new pantheon.
Right,
to bring back to the whole religion kind of idea.
But now you can't even say they're your pantheon. What is archetypal is the use of the medium that these content gods come in. The real archetypes are the media themselves, not the content, because the content changes every 18 months or every 6 months or every five years, right?
Yeah.
It was Madonna before her, and it was Marilyn Monroe. You could list them off in all the different fields.
So they're relevant, right?
Yeah, even the human thing is even, it's really what is the god today,
right.
This is what McLuhan pointed out, the archetype is the media processing itself. Using a telephone is an archetypal experience. Think of that. And that gets you to look at human repeating patterns from a different angle, a more oblique angle.
Okay. I want to understand this more clearly, because what I'm perceiving right now, though, is like, let's say you have the media personality. Even though the faces change, it's still the same basic human elements that keep coming up, love, betrayal, this
right.
and that, et cetera, et cetera. And the phone as a media doesn't express any I guess, humanist qualities, right? That is the... the media personality or whatever it is, that's what's there. I still don't see. I'm still having trouble grasping how.
That's good.
The medium of that communication is. I mean, it certainly plays a part in it, but
right. Now,
I mean, it is really a transparent. If it's this stage, as you were saying, you know, there all of the sensory. If I shouldn't say if you were saying, as I perceived you as saying. I mean, technology has progressed where, I mean, it's all really multimedia is multimedia, right? So it almost becomes transparent.
Right. So I'm saying I have a way to respond to that.
Okay.
What I consider the eternal human content, I would call our soul, and I would call it first nature.
Okay.
And I believe, though I don't know if this is important to mention this, to believe that the souls come from somewhere else and they occupy this dimension. Now, even if they didn't, even if we only have one life and we're just created, the eternal human dilemma, the human personality, is operating in a second nature. And that second nature is, from language on, what humans use to communicate. And the interplay between, say, speech, then the manuscript, and then the printed book, and then movie, these change the way people talk. So what stays here when we die, when human bodies die, what stays here is the technology, the language, and it keeps being built or resonating or whatever you want to say. It evolves. But humans only see themselves in the content. But what humans miss is the interesting, because they're concerned about these eternal patterns, and they either reincarnate back into them all the time, or they experience it once and it's always the same. This is where Jung talks about the archetypes of the person. But what about the media and how it changes the second nature that we humans created? We didn't create the first nature, but we created the second nature, which you're calling technology. I include that in the term language and media. That is what science or knowledge of understanding our environment should be focused on. Because nobody stops the eternal fascination with love, sex, and death, right?
Right.
So there's our doubleness. We are first nature. We have these eternal patterns, and we're always interacting with the way they're expressed. And so that one style of expression doesn't have a popularity when another and another one takes over. The one that takes over may have a bias in it that meets the larger technological bias, linguistic or second nature bias, that's the environment one is shivering or being hot in. So we're looking at the process of where we are today, and not just in focusing on the eternal archetype. So that would be a natural problem when we started talking of mixing up these two factors that I've divided. You know what I'm saying? That's why you were confused, because you were just you didn't divide them. You see these archetypes,
okay,
and they're important, but I'm pointing out some other archetypes.
Okay.
That
well,
we created.
One question to completely try and wrap my head around this. You got the first person, which is the soul, and then you have the second person, which is the language and communication.
Yeah. You're what, even your clothes. What you're wearing.
Okay. Where does the first medium of communication, the shell with which the soul communicates, which is my body, so to speak.
Yeah.
Where does that fit between first and second?
I think it's thought.
Hmm?
I think it's thought was the first medium.
Oh, thought? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. No, okay. Well, solar thought, but I mean, when I use my vocal cords to communicate and such, I guess that's language. That's the second person? Like my body is a shell, so to speak?
Your question was, where was the interface, or what is the interface between the two natures, right?
I assume my body is the interface. How does it fit in? Or is that just what it is, an interface between the two?
Ah, okay, good. No, that's right, because you could look at these second nature technologies, are mimings, replayings of parts of our body. So the eye sees, and then the book comes along as an extension of the eye, a simulation.
Okay. Well, there's no separation between the eyeball and the book or the page, so to speak.
Right.
Got it.
They mime. Now, that's where the second nature is miming the body. Now, the body is miming or put together by processes we don't fully understand in first nature, right? It's organized.
Right.
And we don't know, they still have the battle over psychosomatic diseases, you know, or do people think a certain way, emote a certain way, and that create reactions in the body.
Right.
So if we put the physical body as the interface between first nature, which is maybe thought, maybe something else, and second nature, what is miming the body, then that would describe where the body is. It's in between. And then we would say, well, we're not sure what the body is. That's why I was saying medicine, by getting you to memorize the biological body, is missing the newer body that's part of the capital B body that you've just pointed out as the interface, which is an ongoing mystery. I call it the mystery body. The mystery body is the interface between these five bodies that we have. Five bodies being the neuron body, what 20th century science says you're made up of, chemistry, so to speak, and maybe physics thrown in. Then you have the astral body, your spiritual body, which is something that is not limited to the physical. I don't know the, don't want to say what the limitations or dimensions of that astral body are. Then we have second nature, mimes those two bodies. TV mimes the neuron body, the TV screen body, and the chip body, the internet world, the cyber digital world we have, which is invisible, like the astral body. It is the fourth body. All four of them come together to make up a mystery body, which you were trying to get at when you said, what's the interface between first and second nature? When you asked, is it the body, right?
What's it, kind of, yeah. What is the difference between the astral body and the soul, then?
No difference. I would say that...
But, but if the fifth body is the interface, wouldn't that create some kind of division?
Fifth body is the total of what we are that we never fully understand. So every culture maps their version of the body. You know, you go to the old anthropological thing, they have certain... I mean, the medieval period, they thought we had four humors, right?
Yeah.
Four gases, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that was their cultural map, and that was their body. But it's never the whole body.
Yeah.
And we're still trying to figure out what the whole body is, and I'm throwing into the pot, well, we're growing other bodies, technological bodies, that make up this whole body that we should be aware of when we recognize the limitations of our mapping of the mystery body.
Yeah, no, I was saying the fifth body just to encompass the whole.
Yeah, I got
a grasp of that. I was just, because I'm picturing the whole of the body, so to speak, as being the interface between the soul and, I guess,
technology.
Media, the and technology.
Exactly.
The astral body is very
simple. The mystery body. It's
right.
More than those.
Okay.
Or it may not be more than those. That's what we don't know.
Right.
Right, but, you know, that's okay.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good. Now, is that an epiphany? It's definitely an idea, a pattern. Now, what is it? Maybe we don't know if it's an epiphany because we don't know its staying power yet.
You know what? I was exactly going to say it is. I'm definitely thinking of things in a different way. I'm just not sure how useful that information. Like, no, I'm using that.
Careful.
I'm sorry. I have to be careful in the way I use my words. But remember, when I was talking about an epiphany being something
useful.
On a greater scale of climbing that. For me, I picture it as climbing a ladder of understanding.
Yeah, now one could analyze what is usefulness and break it apart. But, you know, too much analysis, too much breaking apart questioning doesn't allow the body to relax. And epiphany is something that you relax on. So we create a filter, a limitation, and call it an epiphany so we can float and relax. Because if you're in, you know, if you want to have someone pass the butter to you, and you say, well, you know, does this body really need that butter? What if I ignore the hunger pains and not have that, or the desire pains? Imagine thinking every moment as much, meditating on that. You'd have to go away and leave society and be in a monastery to work on that.
Right.
So we have to balance, negotiate how much we want to withdraw and look at the processes and how much we want to float. And that comes back to our point between when does individual identity get asserted in relation to the need to conform and get along and be useful.
Yeah.
Help other people eat butter.
Yeah.
Serve them butter. Help make the cows that create the milk to make the butter.
Right.
That's all obsolete imagery now. It's made by virtual chemical factories and it's not really butter anymore, right?
Right.
And so the we're breaking down things with speech. Here, breaking apart, ripping apart, splicing, because we have the time right now to do it. When you say useful, that's what you want to figure out. How much does this apply to the floating part of myself within social conformity? I mean, the animal rights people say, hey, don't kill these animals, you know, and they want to interrupt the whole processing, the huge slaughterhouse industry of animals. A lot of people are addicted to meat. They require that. How much do you upset people? These may be considered just rhetorical questions, but I'm asking you to look at the meaning of usefulness.
Right.
That, you could really deconstruct that a lot. So how much, you know, there may be factors like astrology, there may be astrological signs, astrological processes that determine the way the person is uses their mind and their deconstructive abilities. And in a community, you got different signs, different peoples, then you you got to be careful how much you're interfering with someone's natural temperament. So just thinking like we are is being violent in relation to other types.
Right.
So, you know, when you see the headlines and they keep showing, when they show a picture of the president, George Bush, that ain't what he is. George Bush is an image processing through all these media, and he also has to be a non-image because certain parts of his pattern cannot be public knowledge. You need national security, right?
Right.
So you're forever duped by your senses and their extensions, these technologies. So how much do you want to engage in it? I mean, I understand Time Magazine's running a poll, and right now it's a poll on who is the greatest threat to world peace.
I'm sorry, who is the greatest which?
Who is the greatest threat? What is
the greatest
threat to your peace?
Right.
To the world peace. And at 70%, the audience is saying the United States. Compared to Iraq and North Korea. This is the American.
Yeah.
Who's doing that? Is this an intelligence agency doing this for some reason? Is it people actually, five people just, you know, re-voting? Because it's an online poll.
Right.
How can we even begin to know what it's measuring? But this is what we put up as something to be concerned about today.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. But you know, depending on your astrological stripe, your political stripe, you could be appalled at that fact or amazed or excited.
Right.
Canadian, you'd be excited. There's probably a lot of Canadians voting on that poll.
That's funny.
And yet, that is allowed to be on the media. And so someone comes out, you know, someone makes a lie. Somebody makes a silly little statement, like Trent Lott mentions the Civil War or 1948. That one statement becomes an atomic bomb for his career. And yet, we're focusing, filtering on a myth compared to the illusory stuff that's constantly being generated. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
So actually, we don't rely on gods anymore. Let's think, what would be the opposite of gods? These are retarded images. J-Lo is a retarded image to remind you of what ain't where we are today. So the archetypes aren't gods on the Olympus. They are archetypes in hell. In terms of, I'm trying to create a negative image, you know?
Yeah.
Where people are worshiping negative imagery. That's nowhere near, it's an illusion. It's nowhere near what is actually processing them. So that would explain why porn is taking over Hollywood. You know, it's the biggest industry now. Porn. And they have their own banks, and they now don't allow anybody to apply to the industry. They have too many people already successful enough to make money for the next 20 years. No more new people can get in. The established porn people.
Wow.
And that who's that woman who's on TV, Carol? Well, I saw her on TV. I don't know if she's TV. You know, the silly one?
No, I'm not.
Anna Nicole.
Have
you guys heard of Anna Nicole up in Canada?
Yeah.
Oh, you've heard her. I see, you've heard her, because you don't live in Canada. You live in the same place I live, which is this node, right? Now, I just saw a bit of it, but you know that your grandmother would think it would be quite disgusting to be like Nicole. And Nicole. But talk about getting dumber. I'm going to flip it now. The dumber you are, the better you are, because you're reminding us of our human nature as we get disappeared. And then you get different media with different memes. Like the New York Times will be outraged. The newspaper meme from the 90s will be outraged at Anna Nicole. But the MTV cyber crowd will be celebrated. So there are a battle of memes there. And they don't even teach you about memes. Here it is, where actual reality. You know, the word should be on the lips of every grade 2-year-old. Or grade 2, a person in grade 2, 8-year-old, 7-year-old. Right? They should be allowed to talk about this. That's what they're up against. But, Dad, what are the memes saying today? That's if they have a dad. They say to their fellow memes, what are the other memes saying?
Wow. So could... sorry, just looking back, say, on the you know, pantheons, right, with multiple gods.
Yeah.
Memes in and of themselves are almost like those too, are they not?
Yeah.
Like as opposed to the media personalities of these people, I think I'm saying what you were saying before. I'm not sure, but it's actually the memes that take on these archetypical aspects, almost like they're thoughts of themselves.
Right, and but I was agreeing with you when we, a meme is a cultural habit. The gods were cultural habits for hundreds of years in Greece,
yeah,
in that area. So they definitely were memes, right? They were shared imageries,
yeah,
that people agreed on, didn't argue too much over what they didn't deconstruct them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so memes are what we don't deconstruct.
Okay, here's a question then. You got a meme. Once a meme is created because somebody thought of it, so to speak, can that other people tap into that and understand it, even if they have no communication with the original thinkers?
Ah, now that is exactly where the word meme came from. Do you know the famous 100th monkey story?
The 100th monkey?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I may have heard it. I'm not familiar with that title, though.
Yeah, in the 60s or 70s, a scientist went and studied this island with had apes on it.
Okay.
And observed them. And one day, an ape did, in the group there of apes, a monkey did something that none of the others did. I don't know. It improvised a way to beat a rock or something.
Right.
Did a particular... you remember? Were they taught to do that? Yeah. This monkey began to dig up roots and wash them in the shore, on the water, before they ate them. Just suddenly happened, and somebody observed this. Then what was amazing, they went to other islands where others of the same species were, and they were doing it too, quite shortly, even though there was no contact between the original group. They did notice that as the other monkeys in the original group began to imitate the first monkey, at a certain point, they figured out it spread to others of the same species on another island. Sort of like when it got to the 100th monkey. Do you know what I mean?
Okay. I've never heard this story before. That's interesting.
Yeah, this is an actual scientific thing.
That's
and,
really neat.
So then you start saying, okay, what does this mean? So my temporary hypothesis was that there is a communication in first nature between species or within species that we can't fully see, but it goes on. The animals are closer than their physical location, all right?
Okay. I'm familiar with the traditional interpretation of like what a species is per se, but why is it species? Like, why is it limited to that as opposed to all thinking things or creatures that are capable of perception? Like, why species per se?
Yeah, why just within the monkeys? Yeah,
yeah,
why
yeah.
Why
yeah.
Why
and
why it, the horses do it?
Yeah, or apes or even other things with opposable thumbs like or something.
Right. So maybe I'm going to say this, then I want to finish what I was going to tell you.
Oh, sorry for interrupting.
That particular question is that this may be the doubleness in all nature, is that species are connected within themselves and connected in the larger whole, but there's a gap where each species has its walls within its own species as opposed to another species. There's a gap. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Okay, aside from that, so what I decided to do was when I saw the 100th monkey effect and thought of the connection within species, and there's also connections within all species because that's the order in nature. What birds do, where they fly south, and all those patterns they have. There's obviously an ecology among different species, something that looks like a pretty organized ecology. But what I decided was that we humans, in our second nature that we're inventing, our technologies and languages, that we are miming the ESP that was manifested in the 100th monkey effect. We more and more are miming in our technologies a close intimacy or a manifesting through our technologies of the intimacy humans already have within itself as a species. And so I call that the meme. And then I say it's different from the 100th monkey meme. It's the android meme. It's a technological meme, something humans made, a second nature. So the you were asked, how does it spread, right? I think that's what you said. How does it spread?
Originally, well, I just had a question if a meme was identified, if it did spread or not. But I would be curious as to how it spread. That sounds good. That's a good question.
Yeah. Well, what's amazing is when we don't know when a first human started grunting or talking, uttering sounds, we don't know why the glue made the meaning stay in another human being's mind.
Right.
And then they could say it, share it. But obviously it's stuck somehow. And then they build up, and then they could improvise, and then someone will come up with new stuff, and then it'll eventually stick. We don't know how things stick to us. But that's obviously how we, why we can communicate, because in a sense, it could be a reflection of the spiritual oneness that humans have. We're all the same person, the same consciousness here.
Right.
So that's why you can understand me, at least begin to understand me, and then the, each culture gets more sophisticated, more complex. But have you ever thought about why you can even understand me? And in other words, why you can even hear me?
I kind of have my own theory on that, but...
What's your own theory? Will you cite from different memes we already established that others have built for you?
Oh, probably. I'm sure. I mean, there's obviously very few original thoughts, so to speak, at least at my stage here. But what a kind of picture is, I mean, we perceive the world through our perceptions, right? And I mean,
I could accept those words or put them or destroy them. What does it mean through our perceptions?
I witness the world through.
I was just say you are.
Okay, I am.
Yeah, you are.
One of the things that, as I am, and my recognition of who I am is due to the progression of time, right?
Yeah.
I guess I perceive time as in numerous instances, whether it be dreaming or anything else, time does dilate. It is highly perceptive to me from what I've perceived. And because of that...
Now, watch what you said. It's highly perceptive to what you perceive.
Oh, sorry. Well, no. As far as I perceive things... Time in and of itself is...
As far as you are...
As far as I am...
You experience something.
Yes. Time dilates. It's not a constant.
Ah, no, that's interesting. Now, dilates means expands?
I'm sorry, expands and contracts.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you feel...
Flexible.
...that your earnest, your aiming...
Yeah.
...it feels differences.
Yes.
That's as far as we really establishing by using the word time.
Okay.
You feel differences.
Okay.
In your processing of some of being am.
Now with mum. How do I put this? If one were to perceive, or if my am was to perceive the flow of time slightly differently, it would not be unreasonable to picture humanity being.
No, you're jumping to humanity. We're just talking about you.
Okay. Well, my place in humanity.
Yeah.
As being me attached to an umbilical cord, attached to another human who's attached to umbilical cords to create a massive tree, which is one entity that moves not as we move physically, but actually moves through time.
Yeah.
And that's why I perceive as same as if we were all individual cells in one greater body, so to speak, while we might only have awareness of ourselves, we still function because we're all receiving the same signals or communication through that greater body.
Why did you go from what you perceive in the dilating of time to talking about the greater body?
I'm not saying the greater body is in the fifth body. I'm talking about the greater body is in humanity. Like,
well, you mean other humans that look like you?
No, I'm talking all of humanity. Like, if stemming back to...
No, I don't... You know, all of humanity is what I meant by humans that look like you.
Sure.
Did you mean dogs?
Well, dogs are canines. They're not humanity, right?
Right, yeah. So...
Yeah.
You are noticing, the I am notices a bunch of others around.
Yeah. Actually, theoretically, it could stem back to dogs and everything else, too. There's no reason why it wouldn't. It would stem back to whatever the first cell that... I don't have a very strong backing in science in that
right.
regard, but that stretches out so that we all are interconnected. We're just moving together through time, right?
Yeah, but you're not inclined to have sex with a dog.
No, because we're far on the tree. We're very far separated.
So there's the separation we were talking about.
Yeah.
Why the communication stays within species.
Right. There's certain, I guess, one-way doors, so to speak.
Yeah.
As you're traveling down, that you don't go back up. Once
yeah.
you've walked through that door,
right.
then you're part of that pool or that community.
Okay. Now, why are you emphasizing this pool?
In general, the reason I'm talking about it is because you were mentioning before, why are we able to communicate with one another?
Right.
And my belief is for the same reason that my fingers work together and everything else, because I'm part of the same organism.
Right. Okay, yeah.
That's how it ties in.
Now, I bet you most humans would accept that thought. So why? So it's been answered, the question. So what are we trying to answer when science in its various disciplines is trying to figure out an answer to that question?
Well, that's not a theory. I mean, that's not an answer. That's just a theory, right?
No, it makes sense.
It does make sense, but I mean, there's no...
Okay, it may not be a theory, but it satisfies a definition of two humans among themselves about what they are.
Right.
And it couldn't be denied.
Right.
Isn't it the famous scientist Popper, or the theorist, said, a scientific theory is true if you can disprove it.
Right.
There's So that's why... So you made a statement. Then you said, no, it's just a theory. You actually transferred the statement into the meme of science, which could say, no, we could disprove that.
Right.
But that's second-guessing. And you know where science came from? When you start to write. When you could write down something, you replay what someone said, you could second-guess them. So the physics of writing and printing created science as we know it.
Right. I'm sorry, my phone's dying here.
Oh, are we on your
phone? Give me 1 second. Oh. Hello?
Yeah,
I'm there. Hey, Bob, I'm just going to transfer phones because of the battery on the wireless.
Oh, okay.
Here he is. He's just moving to a chair.
Hey, Matt, are you listening to this?
Hello?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay.
Hey, Matt, how's it going?
Oh, I think Matt's off now.
Oh, he's not, but I thought he had headphones on.
He did have headphones on.
Can you put your headphones on for a second?
He's just putting them back on.
Okay.
He's on.
Hey, Matt.
Oh, yeah, Bob.
It's late.
You haven't been listening?
Of course I have.
Oh, okay, but you took them off.
No. I had to take them off to switch phones for Adam because we heard the battery's dying.
Okay, good. What do you think so far?
If we could recapture this on a weekly basis, this is incredible.
Oh, you're liking it?
It's phenomenal.
Good. Adam's doing good.
I'm giddy. There's going to be sound effects of me going like this in the background because I'm holding myself back.
So good. Yeah, Adam's doing good here.
Well, this is I couldn't imagine. Yeah.
Okay, good. So Adam, let's continue the intensity. What question or statement comes to your mind now at this point of what we had just said? Not about Matt, but
right.
We were talking about humanity and science.
Right. Okay. For myself, okay, let's just take it very well then as a fact, so to speak, that we're all this we're one stretching big organism.
Yes.
And that's why we can communicate, because we're all part of the same whole.
We have a kind of ESP.
Right. Well, it's not even ESP, because there's no separation. I mean, well, no, I guess, I'm sorry, I'm using ESP
right.
as being a very traditional.
I'm bringing up a term that I know is not a recognized phenomenon, still questioned, so I am guilty of bringing in a term just to stir up the pot. So, hey, what about that term? Why can't we bring that in? So,
well,
we can use any other term, I guess.
Yeah,
it's
I mean...
play.
Yeah.
Because they know the rules. See, there's a game can only happen if the rules are known. And the rules can be arbitrary, but they're followed. Humans know the game. They know the rules because it's like ESP. And
right.
So we play.
They intuitively know them?
Yeah. We're all
right.
The same species. We know the rules.
That's right.
Because we can register each other.
Then why do we have to... Oh, okay, here's a question. Maybe this relates. Certain animals, they obviously have instincts. Therefore, they're born with a set of rules. However, humans have to actually teach their young the rules. Not all the rules, by any means, but certain rules.
Yeah, now that's a good point, because what they do is speak. An animal has instinct rules, first nature rules.
Right.
We have to integrate the first nature kid that comes out of nature, created by parents.
Right.
But we then interface them with our second nature.
Right. So we have customizable children, as opposed
right.
to animals that
we
just come in one shape and color.
We remake nature with our second nature, which is language.
Right.
I once asked somebody, what was the difference between, you know, speaking between animals and animals and humans? And if I can remember, animals and birds, they have memory. They pass on the rules to their species. But humans... can improvise, change the rules.
Right.
That's what's different.
Animals can too. It's just it takes much, much longer. Like, we
right.
can do it within the course of one generation, right?
Yeah, like that monkey changed the rules.
Yeah.
And they do it, so we're faster.
Right.
So in that sense, we're not the top of first nature creations. We are the best and have leaped into the second nature creation.
Right.
The others are still too slow at it. We could say we're at the top of second nature creation.
And ultimately, our evolution would be moving to fifth nature. like through that progression, wouldn't you want to move through each of the natures?
No, all technologies are second nature. So.
Yeah, but you know, what I'm saying is, you said we're better because we're the best because we've moved into second nature. Therefore,
yeah,
would we not be better if we moved into third and then into fourth and then through into the fifth, so we have a full understanding of all them?
I'd say this is that we have left first nature and are involved in second nature, and we can do it faster.
Okay.
If we admit that some animals can do a little bit of it. But
okay.
It's nowhere near what we're doing, so we've left nature.
Okay.
Actually, humans are have left.
Yeah.
and we are creating so much second nature stuff that a lot of first nature is being intimidated and being supposedly destroyed.
Got it.
And yet we've gone over to the other side, so to speak.
Yeah.
And we don't know how to relate first nature back in.
Right.
And yet we are in the interface between the two on
yeah.
the body level.
Yeah, because, I mean, we do have obviously a lot of first nature still floating about.
Yeah. So we're not the crown of creation. We're the interface of creation, I might add an S in brackets. The two natures, right?
That's interesting.
So it always comes down to that. Think of what we educate the kids with obsolete stuff that conditions them, that makes them incapable of being smart adults.
Yeah, but the only way not to educate them in obsolete stuff would be to literally throw them into, how do I put it? I'm going to use workforce in a very vague term. I don't mean putting them, you know, to work.
Right.
But the only way really for anyone to not be learning obsolete information is to be doing it as it's evolving, right?
Right.
You literally have to be taking the kids and throwing them right on a front line, so to speak, so that they're living and they're in that. Like they're making the changes and they're a part of it. Like almost like apprenticeships or that kind of co-op type idea.
And the way you see kids pick up language and learn, they might
yeah.
be able to do it. But we're conservative in the sense that it's good. We have a respect for all the previous old second nature creation we've made. We put
right.
the kids through that. They go through the stages. But the real problem, and Norbert Wiener and these people discussed this, you know, big thing after World War II is as the masses came back and you had the post-World War II affluence.
Right.
They then said, well, what do we teach the kids, and how do we make these kids smarter? And so the eternal problem of how you take a kid, you condition them, and then they become an adult through some ritual, they then are on their own, and they're supposed to have learned from the past, programming we've given them, how to adapt to the new. Then we throw them into the present.
Right.
All societies did that. Now, Norbert Wiener and these guys were trying to figure out how to make these kids geniuses, and they were up against the problem of how do you trigger a mind which
yeah.
is learning all your stuff, and you know it's not too relevant to the problems of what you have to do today because you might need different perceptions, especially in the 20th century when new technologies require different perceptions. So that could be why, you know, education is so faulty because it can't keep up with the process.
Yeah.
And so then the real education was taking in every day on what kids processed in the regular media.
Yeah.
The J-Lo stuff. Now, I think I jumped away where I was going. I wanted to say that the epiphany process, that's what the epiphany is that you use former media, even locally speech, to condition someone. Then you say, okay, I've conditioned you. Now, I've got to get you to forget everything you've learned. So that you can do this.
Yeah.
And if you do it, it's an epiphany. You pass on an epiphany.
Right.
So it's not a big picture. It is a flexibility. I like McLuhan's definition of imagination. He says it's that which is not embedded in any technology or extension or any language. It's detached.
Yeah.
Any writer has a flexibility with his word materials. You know, he can play with it. People who are embedded and not imaginative are too embedded. We might say they take things too literally.
And then they're not benefiting, I guess, the growth of humanity, so to speak, because they're not creating anything new. They're just trapped in your after images, so to speak.
Right. But the part of us that wants to create new,
yeah.
then that's good. But we also don't want to create too much new. So we're naturally ecological, so we've got to have people who are not imaginative to slow down the process.
Right. Now, why don't we want too much new?
Because it was just like, imagine you never getting a chance to re-listen to this conversation.
Right.
A lot of newness at
you. You'd lose a lot.
You lose a lot, and also you'd be under a stress that, hey, I don't know what I got, you know?
Right.
And so we need to slow it down by the ability to replay it.
So it's almost like, I guess.
Take too much. What?
No, I was just picturing, I mean, ultimately, in a perfect world, so to speak, education would be allowing people kind of to stand on the shoulders of giants, where they understand exactly, they get the foundation to build up on everything that's happened in the past, but they're still offered the flexibility to be able to continue on in the future, whereas now all we've done is basically give them a foundation of the past and told them to stick with it.
Right. And that's only in what's called education.
Yeah.
And those teachers are dealing with kids or being programmed by other teaching machines outside the classroom.
Yeah.
That really confuses the process.
Right.
Now, one could say that kind of, you know, anarchists say, oh, if only we had anarchy. We have anarchy. We have perceptual anarchy constantly. And that actually, this may be good. The, you know, the American ingenuity, if it is a better society, North America, there's a lot of assumption there, but if we said it was better and Europe's too slow, it's because the schooling is not so traditional. The kids got so many data and filtering processes they got to work on that they're actually quite flexible people, and they can process a lot of stuff. And it's the anarchy that creates that situation and creates more in tune humans.
You know, could that possibly be because due to the anarchy, people are forced to, on a level that no one else could even hope to touch them, they're forced to take accountability and responsibility for themselves, to filter that information, to become the people they want to be.
Right. And now, let's say that it's a myth that children are different from adults.
Oh, certainly.
Okay. No, it may not be, but let's just accept that. Then our society should have kids growing up on their own.
Well,
and so, therefore, divorce and all that stuff is considered negative that creates latchkey kids is actually an evolutionary progress. The kids are learning how to live on their own earlier, and they have to deal with the society. That was just a thought.
No. That's interesting. Because the only thing I would say in regards to kids is, I honestly believe children do. I mean, they're perfectly capable of thinking and making rational decisions. They just lack a foundation of experience when they're younger, which is why they need parents, I mean, so that fire doesn't burn them, et cetera, right?
Right.
They need to learn those things.
That's right. They aren't able to be functioning, but it's like maybe by 10, 12, they could be.
Well, I remember reading somewhere that they're talking in medieval times. I know that's come up a few times already. But children were considered adults as soon as they got mastery of language, which was roughly about the age of 7. And therefore, in that era, I mean, by the time you're 7, you're off on your own, you're doing your own thing. And you know
you're not going to get burnt. You understand the basics.
Yeah, you understand the basics, and they're treated like adults. So it's kind of funny, when reading older books, we often say, oh my God, how could they treat children that way? But they really weren't. It was just they were just other adult members of society.
Yeah, some sociologists say the idea of childhood came in Western societies with print.
Right.
Now, what's interesting, print was a new language, new information that had to be processed. So you actually had to take that little kid, that little adult, and put him aside in a little simulation room, a classroom, and process new burden. They were put to work when they went to school. They couldn't be, and so the very fragmentation of the kid away from the normal non-book world created the concept of childhood or adolescence. They were separated out. It actually wasn't an evolutionary stage. They had to be put off into the virtual reality of books. So that's where childhood came from. The idea of children was a result of the printing press.
Wow.
And then now as we get post-printing press, and everybody, you know, by the time they're 3, is processing all kinds of information on TV and the family TV,
there's no
separating. That's why the kids mature faster,
maybe
biologically grow faster, and all these things that people are observing, they're becoming where the print category is falling away.
Right.
They still use it in their culture, but it doesn't apply to the actual experience. They're little adults by the time they're 8.
That's interesting.
So that's another thing. But here's I'll tell you what's going to happen in 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'd say even less. I have it on good authority that here's how education will be. They'll put a kid in a virtual chamber, like a virtual test tube.
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually talk to the kid remove them from their experience and talk to them and say, what's going on? They would describe, well, I do this, I do that, blah, blah, blah. And they'd have a whole life. They have girlfriends or whatever, and they would not know that it was inside a virtual tube. Now, that's a new kind of classroom. We began it with books. We began it with we have it with education today. But think of putting a child, a young adult, in this virtual tube, and for the first 15 years, they're having a whole life. They think they travel, like they think they're older than they are.
Right.
And their brain's being programmed with all these movies, virtual movies.
Mm.
That's how we're going to be programmed. Now, does that upset you? Would you like children to be like that? Is that an uncomforting scenario for the future for your perceptions and biases?
For my biases, there's one major concern I'd have with that, is because everything would be so planned. There'd be no random elements.
They might be able to plan it in. That's why the kid thinks that he's having an interesting life, you know.
Right.
He's quite flexible.
You think they could do that? Like, I'm just picturing, it's kind of like, there was a movie a few years ago where a big meteor was coming to Earth. It was going to wipe it out.
Yeah.
The reason I'm bringing that up is because selecting, like, the best and the brightest of humanity and sheltering them away in the 1,000-person shelter
right.
isn't necessarily the best for humanity in the long run, because
no.
there might be a disease that comes in or some such
right.
where there's one particular gene that someone who wasn't selected might have had. So it's almost better to if you're going to have to limit the amount of people that go into a shelter, so to speak, you got to randomly select
yeah.
from the pool to best further the chances of humanity surviving as a whole.
Yeah.
And I kind of picture the same as with education. I mean, there's a lot more education, or you learn a lot more from what happens outside of the classroom just by going to schools, interacting with people and everything else than you do necessarily from the books you're studying.
Yeah, especially now, since the books are so puny.
Yeah.
It's so minor.
But by streamlining that education process to such a degree that everything is determined for the student, I suspect that we could run into problems in the future.
Right.
Because there is no truly random element.
Right. So from your experience of what, remember, you're citing your experience of schools.
Right.
And using your bodies, your physical body, interacting with general media environments, the other bodies, but they don't seem to be dominant. I guess what I'm describing is where the chip body has become major input shaper.
Oh, okay. I see. I mean,
yeah, not the physical body that bumps into people in the hall and that, you know.
Right.
Now they could be it could be developed that the person is simulatingly wise, experiencing these social interactions. Yeah, I guess he has a girlfriend and he has a social life within this test tube. His brain does.
Right.
He's actually doing. He thinks he's doing what you're doing.
Would they actually be interacting? No, I understand that. Would they actually be interacting with other students, or would all of these pseudo girlfriends and pseudo classmates and stuff programs?
They'd be having different social, almost like the 20th century life,
right?
In the test tube.
Right, but the other personalities, are they actually people? Like, is it a virtual classroom?
Yeah.
What I mean, where there are actually 20 individuals and 20 different test tubes that actually
right.
communicate together
like
in the same classroom?
The
yeah.
The
oh, yeah, no, I mean, I see that as, that'd be great.
You think that'd be great?
Oh, absolutely. It's just if each, like, the thing I would be worried about is, let's say you have 20 separate people and 20 different test tubes, and all of them are reliving the exact education experience, being the same star character, so to
right.
speak, in the same movie. Because there I could see there being huge problems. Do you see the difference of what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And it was interesting. When you said that would be great, I then thought, okay, we're projecting ahead, that's great. But to the kid experiencing it,
right.
they wouldn't think what they were doing is great. They wouldn't even notice it.
Oh, absolutely.
They have an image of a future situation that would be a great to them.
Yeah. Oh no. Of course. Yeah. No. No. I mean, it'd be.
Is that an of course? That's an of course statement.
Yeah. It'd be a standard. I mean, it'd be the same. It's natural as breathing air for them, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what they grew up with. So
right.
that's their reality. So how would they feel any differently?
So why would you think it was great?
Oh, for me?
Yeah, because you're not going to be involved in it. That's why it's great to you. To them, it's not great. It's.
It's natural.
So I'm just taking that phrase and just looking at it, what it means when you go, that'd be great.
Well,
you're never going to experience it because it would be great when you got there.
Yeah, but I mean, it's my role as a responsible human being to look towards the future of humanity, right? For my children and everything else.
Out of the present.
Of course.
I'm not saying that that's wrong. But
okay.
You're projecting out of the present. You are an illusion. your projection is an illusion. Now, illusion, is that bad or is that real? Is an illusion real?
Well, I would almost think an illusion by its very nature is something I can't tell whether it's real or not, even though it isn't real.
Yeah.
Whereas for me,
you knew that would be real, in the sense that it would be great.
Oh, no, it would be wonderful if it happened. I mean, but I still realize that as I stare ahead, I mean, that's something yet to come, right?
Yeah.
Or, no, I guess that would be more delusional if I didn't think.
Actually, it's not. It's actually the way, what I just described 100 years ago,
right,
is the way we've been living for the last 70 years since radio. Our screen body and our chip body,
right,
the later development, we actually live. Kids live like that. They live in a matrix. That's why The Matrix is an old-fashioned movie.
Right.
It's about 1984, so to speak, or even 1954.
Hmm.
And that's maybe why it's so popular.
Right.
Because it confirms what people knew. It's the old. What is new to tell people is, hey, we are not on The Matrix anymore. George Bush is not on The Matrix. He doesn't need to communicate to us. That's why he seems to be saying silly things, doesn't even complete a sentence. He's not talking. He is a caveman walking around the little virtual marble we're inside of. And he's outside of it, and he's having a fight with somebody. We don't even know what it is. We're out of The Matrix now. That's Bob's message of recent. So that's something to think about, maybe.
That's interesting.
Because we've been in a matrix for so long. So right when, you know, I read the Newsweek, one of those magazines, had a big article on the Wachowski brothers. I assume you've seen The Matrix.
Yeah.
And the new movies are coming out this year, two of them, I think. And they had a big cover story. They're 37, 35. One brother, I don't know what one brother does, but the other reads philosophical books.
Right.
And gets his ideas. I think the other one reads science fiction, the other reads philosophy. So, he reads science fiction. He reads what he thinks is about the future. He does know he's making movies about the past.
That's kind of funny.
Try to tell that to them. They would. If I told them that, you're nuts. We're called. It is the future. People think it's the future. We're making millions, making it as the future. We don't want to hear about how it's the past.
Right.
But no reviewer had ever said that. I'm the first reviewer to say that. Some people might say, oh, it's sort of like the way we're going or we are today. The internet. Nah, it happened 40, 80 years ago.
Yeah.
Try to tell that to your local teacher. They wouldn't agree with me. But the point is, I know I'm on the right track.
Yeah. So just to make sure that I'm understanding you, effectively, as soon as two people were able to communicate as if they were in the same room, even though they were, let's say, thousands of miles apart, they've effectively created a virtual place, a virtual world. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Because I can make things happen.
Yeah.
In a house. So, where mm-hmm. Matt lives. I forget the address. No, so someone's walking down the street.
Yep.
And there are things being moved around.
Yep.
They didn't show the phone. And they would not, they think, oh, that guy's doing that because they want. No, he's being directed by someone 10,000 miles away.
Yeah, he's not even there. So for all intents and purposes, yeah, you've transcended physical space, so to speak.
That's right. Physical, we can then start to say,
you've created a new reality.
Body
yeah.
space. Now we have these other spaces. So that's why I say the last 150 years, a good phrase for this, at the time when everybody's worrying about genetic cloning, but we have cloned human ESP. We have cloned ESP. Now, first of all, what is ESP? You can't see it. But we are actually cloning it. Well, I can't see electricity.
Yeah.
So think of that. They're all worried about genetic cloning, and I'm saying the Matrix is about our cloned ESP the last 100 years. See, that's a good phrase, but it's actually exact, because you just walked yourself into thinking what I meant before I said it, right? You just figured out that we're in a different space here.
Well, yeah, yeah.
So cloning ESP, you've never heard that phrase before.
I've never heard of cloning ESP, no.
No, and that is actually, if we think of the communication between human species, like the monkeys had within their species, they knew the rules instinctively.
Yeah.
There's an ESP among humans.
Yeah.
You use the word ESP as dramatic, but it shouldn't be dramatic. It's what we have. So why are they still investigating? Why do we have ESP? Do we have ESP? Is it possible? Maybe we haven't seen people levitate things.
Right.
But we we've actually, if humans could do that occasionally, freaks of the human species, we have collectively done it with our electric age.
Yeah, because, I mean, it could easily be argued that if I'm, I don't know where you are right now, but if I'm getting you to lift something, I'm effectively levitating it.
Because
I'm moving it through the power of my mind, thousands of miles away, right?
Through the power of mind, which is thought, which is language, which is speech. So I think that we should title this one Matt Cloning ESP, because that's what we've led to.
Interesting.
So there is an epiphany I've offered you.
That's great. That's neat.
Okay, good.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time.
Right, and so what, I always like to find out, who am I talking to? What is your, what do your physical body do?
What does my physical body do?
Yeah, what does it do?
Oh, I'm an interactive...
Yeah, I just want to get a little bio.
Okay, I'm an interactive project manager. I work for an advertising agency. Basically, I do websites and interactive ID-ROMs and stuff like that. But I kind of jump around a lot. I like to do stuff. I like to get stuff done.
Do you do sports? Do you have hobbies?
I have a lot of hobbies. I'm into role-playing. I like games like Dungeons & Dragons and various other things like that, where I pretend to be other people.
Have you heard of this new Mafia game? I posted it a week or so ago.
There's a new Mafia game? Oh, I'm making a board game all about the Mafia. Oh, this is a live one. No, what's this?
Yeah, get Matt to get that email and go to the article in the New York Observer. It's a new fad here in New York.
Okay.
It's very interesting. And that might be something to talk about if you come back.
Oh, that'd be very interesting.
Yeah. All right, so I get the buy. And so did you grow up in Toronto?
Yeah, I grew up in Toronto.
Okay, Adam, I know Toronto.
Yeah, I do all sorts of different things. I like project managing, getting projects done. I was originally a concept writer. I could do all sorts of stuff, tech, art.
Right.
I just like getting my hands in everything. And I find the more competent you get at any one thing, you just get competent at everything.
Right.
So I guess I'm more of a renaissance person.
Okay.
So I'm working for Nations right now. Okay, so I'll let you go.
Well, nice to meet you, Adam.
It was a pleasure meeting you as well.
Okay, we'll talk soon.
It sounds fantastic.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye.